It's such an honor, Danny, to be part of this amazing podcast you're doing here, and it's just really cool to be talking about this book.
You know my work and you've given it a lot of thought, and I don't normally get such good questions, to be honest.
Your podcast is the one that I listen to when I want to listen to an interviewer who has A, actually read the book she's asking questions about, and B, asks really interesting, insightful questions about it, and I think that's really special.
Thank you for your wonderful questions.
It was a good chat, great chat. You're a good interviewer.
It's an absolute pleasure to be interviewed by a very articulate person such as yourself.
I've so enjoyed listening to the podcast. Truly, I love it. And it does just feel like you're having a chat with your mate.
That's brilliant what you do. Honestly, I'm so in awe, and we need more word nerds like yourself.
Welcome to the Words and Nerds podcast. I'm your host, Danny V. Today I have the great pleasure of speaking with Tara June Winch. Born in Australia and based in France, her first novel, Swallow the Air, was critically acclaimed. She was named a Sydney Morning Herald Best Young Australian Novelist and has won numerous literary awards for Swallow the Air. Today I talk to her about her novel, The Yield. Profoundly moving and exquisitely written, Tara June Winch's The Yield is the story of a people and a culture dispossessed. It is a powerful reclaiming of Indigenous language, storytelling, and identity.
Welcome, Tara. Thank you so much for speaking to me today about your novel, The Yield.
Thanks for having me.
For people who haven't yet read the novel, can you give us a 20-second elevator pitch of what the novel is about?
Actually, it's one of those books that's impossible to do an elevator pitch for. Yeah, it's really tricky to even tell people what it's about. So it's a book that that took a long time to write and a long time to just sort of figure out how it would work. Most of the time in those 10 years that it took me to write, I was just trying to figure out the plot and how every character and every narrative would fit together. And so basically it's a very complicated, I think, oh, it sounds actually horrible. It's a big story about Australia and about the history of colonization in Australia, but then also the history of all time, dreaming time in Australia. And it's a metaphor for Australia, actually. It's all compounded onto 500 acres of farming land in western New South Wales on Nurumbang, which is Wiradjuri for country, along the banks of a fictional river, which is based off the Murrumbidgee River. And there's three narrative strands, there's three narrators that tell the story of all time on these 500 acres.
I loved the parallel threads of Albert August and the letters, and I did think it might have been a complicated write. It wasn't to read, it was beautiful to read. And I was wondering exactly that. How did you bring those three threads together?
Well, I knew that I wanted to tell a story about a metaphor for all Australia, and so to do that, I needed to show all perspectives, and so, and I wanted it to, obviously it's about language, the heart of the book is about language, about the importance of language, and so I've got three narrators. One is, I think it started with Poppy Gondawinda, who opens the book, and his death is imminent. He's an older man, and he wants to pass on to his family everything he's ever remembered. And he tells a story of his life, his people's lives, through a dictionary. It sounds quite boring, but apparently people like reading it. And he's also a time traveller, so he can go through all time, and the concept of the dreaming time, which is that all time exists now at every single present point, past, future. And then, so he's telling the story. It sort of runs like a river through the entire book, and then it alternates with the voice of his granddaughter, which is August, who's returned for the funeral of her grandfather from overseas. She's been kind of exiled overseas, and she's narrating the contemporary action of the novel and what's happening to those 500 acres of land today that are mining companies encroached on the land. And there's a lot of drama about the past and the future of that piece of country. And then there's another third narrator, which is a letter written in 1915 by a Lutheran missionary who started a mission on that same 500 acres back in 1880. And being a Lutheran, being a German in 1915, he's an enemy of the state, and he has a some sort of perspective on what he's done to the local people by being a missionary in that on that piece of land and by denying a people their mother tongue.
And going back to Albert's idea of the dictionary to record history, I just thought it was such a beautiful way to bring back that traditional language and to preserve it as well.
Thank you. Now, which means thank you in Wiradjuri.
Oh, I didn't want to try and pronounce any of them, so thank you for doing that. The novel focuses on so many important issues, and one of them, as you just touched on before, the mining industry and its potential to strip away the lives of the people. And I wanted to ask why this was so important for you to explore in this book.
I wanted to explore the issue of mining because it's always in my mind when I think of Australia, especially actually, it was in Swarthia. I explored mining in a small sense, gold mining in Western New South Wales, which is quite prevalent. While I've been doing these like finalising stages, Adani mine has obviously been in the news a lot and been on my mind, and it was a metaphor as well. I mean, there was multiple layers to the mine coming in. The obvious one is that it is a massive issue, an environmental issue, and the environment is our mother and is so important to cultural connection and language as well. And so the mind is a metaphor that for that hollowing out, you know, that and that ripping away of culture and connection and language. And also I was exploring artefacts, the artefacts of language, but the artefacts on the landscape as well, burial sites, tools. I don't want to give away the plot of the novel, but I wanted to explore the role of museums as well. So all those sort of key issues all interlaced perfectly, and I knew that, yeah, it had to be a tin mine in the end.
And I just thought that exactly was so clever, you know, looking at all the artefacts of language and of tools and then going back to the museum and that, you know, then becoming quite important in their lives. And I just thought it was just so beautiful the way it all came together. And what I liked as well is that it explores the power of protest, because these people, they feel powerless, but they need to stand up for what they believe is right. And I just thought that was such a great message in the face of huge corporations.
Absolutely, it's important. I think that was actually an influence living in France for a lot of writing the book, because protest is such a God-given human right in France, and everyone protests, from, you know, school elderly, school principals, I don't know, to, you know, your neighbours, whole families go out to protest, called manifestation in French. And, you know, every day of the week there's traffic jams and there's road closures because of protests, and it's an acceptable voice, an acceptable movement in France. It's something that Australia really needs to to embrace.
Yeah, I wish
Australia would embrace protest as a human right, basically.
Absolutely, because it's not, isn't it? It's seen on the news as a bit of an inconvenience.
Absolutely, yeah. You know, look at all those breakfast morning shows in Australia where they where they look down on protesters, that they're, I don't know, dregs of society or something. But it's not. It's the passion. It's the lifeblood of civil rights. It's so important to protest, to get out there, and it's a decent behaviour. It's more decent than apathy, than turning a blind eye.
I agree, because then you are complicit in some ways, aren't you? I've spoken about this before, and this is how we've had change throughout history, is by standing up and protesting.
Absolutely. It's one of the saddest developments of the Australian psyche is the distraction to commercialism, the distraction of money in Australia. People aren't... I don't know what they are. Is it television? I don't know what it is, but they're distracted to fighting for their rights.
It seems very individual. I think I spoke about this with someone else, about fighting for kind of to make your life comfortable rather than the greater good.
Yeah. Australia has lost a sense of the greater good. Maybe in sport, in some ways they haven't lost the sense of that mateship, but in terms of you know, having equal rights, in terms of being humane and having a sense of collective humanity, I think they have. It's really sad. Yeah. There's need to look at France, really.
Now, there's a beautiful passage, I thought, on page 248, and it was about a universal feeling of grief. And I just thought anyone reading this book just could relate to it so much. And someone says, "Those final stages went on for a couple of days. The soul and the mind are there, but the body can't do anything else to be with the mind. It's like you became split. The natural split. At that moment, I didn't want it to end. I just wanted another day. Then you want another hour, another minute." And I just thought, how beautiful is that passage? Because it just explains exactly when you're about to lose someone. And I think even though this is a story, you know, about this specific family, we can all relate to this universal sense of grief.
Yeah, I was grieving in the final stages of editing the book as well. I lost my brother recently, just during the final edit. And that those kind of words, there's also, I have talked about pilot whales and that feeling of when you lose someone, sometimes there's an immediate feeling of wanting to die yourself.
Mm.
It's like knee-jerk reaction. And I had that feeling when my brother passed. And I spoke to, I was sort of, it was the day after my brother passed, and I'd rushed back from France to Australia, still in my pyjamas. I didn't take my pyjamas off that morning that I woke up in France until I got back to Sydney. And the next day I was kind of mad in jet lag and grief and rage. And I said to one of our family friends, "I want to die." You know, I had this really strong feeling. It was so illogical, but it was real, you know. It felt tangible. It felt like the answer to all this rage and grief. And he said, "It's normal to feel that way. It's a mammal instinct." And told me about the whales, how pilot whales, when they lose one of the whales beaches themselves, their instinct is to then beach themselves because they don't know. I don't know if this is scientifically factual, by the way. But he said that they don't know how to be a pod without one if they lose one. And it kind of, the fact that it was like, it was a balm, it made me understand my that insane, you know, knee-jerk reaction, that illogical thought. So all these elements of grief and death came into the novel, especially and that idea of wanting another minute, another hour, another day with the person, that all came in those really like last couple of weeks of editing the book, like that raw emotion just raged through in the final edit. So,
and now that you've said that, it's just, you know, that resonated with me so much, and I think it's because it had such truth in those lines.
Yeah, there's nothing but truth in this book. It really broke my heart, not just those final stages, but the whole thing. I was talking to, I'm up at a language conference right now in Darwin, so there's linguists and language groups from all over Australia. You know, there's hundreds of languages up here, language groups up here at the moment, and we're discussing on issues of preservation and reclamation, and it's just incredible. And I was talking to a great poet called Curly Saunders just a couple of hours ago about the work we do and how we're creating stories that are palatable, that you can digest, that you can, you know, you can root for characters and follow a storyline. But in order to tell these great histories, these great traumatic histories and these horrors and genocides, we have to take on all that burden and all that horror and emotion ourselves to then turn it into something that is a work of art.
Mm.
And it's a huge burden. And I said, you know, we took time out this afternoon to take care of ourselves. We had an hour of self-care because it is so, we are political writers. We cannot be anything but political writers, being First Nations writers. And it is a lot. We're giving a lot on the page.
I think as well what summed up the book for me was this beautiful quote that said, "Other people didn't have lumps in their throats year in and year out, century after century. They didn't know what it was like to be torn apart." And I thought that was just one of the quotes that just summed up how these people felt and through the whole novel, and it just really resonated with me.
Yeah, and August, the granddaughter, she, you know, she has a there's an idea of her friendship with this girl from overseas, and there's this sentence I put in there, this sentiment that her friend didn't know what it was to have a terrible inheritance.
Yeah, absolutely. And you don't. And, you know, I'm not even going to pretend that I do know, but reading it, I just, you know, gave me a greater insight. And that's why I thought this book was so important. Now, what is next for you?
I am learning a lot about language. As I said, I'm up here as a student of the world. And I'm always been fascinated with languages. And I'm advocating to get languages into our national curriculum and into preschools and into all schools. I'm really pushing for that. And time I'm writing my fourth novel, and that'll be out a year after.
Wonderful. And I think the idea of getting the traditional language into preschools and schools is such a fantastic idea. I love that.
Yeah, it's important. I mean, it should have just... I've found studies that are decades and decades old saying we need languages in schools.
Mm.
It's so... case studies that say, you know, this is the way to reconciliation, this is the way to empathy, this
Absolutely.
Is the way to healing the national our national identities, because Australians really grapple with their identity, I think, because they don't know how to reckon with the horror of the past. And this is a really easy, tangible way to connect with country, connect with our First Nations people in a respectful way. If we can just change our viewpoint to realise that wherever we are in Australia, whoever we are, we're on someone else's country. At the moment, I'm on Larrakai country, and one of the easiest, most respectful things to do is to learn a few words of someone else's language when you go to a different country, whether it be France or Bali. You know, when you travel there, you pick up a few words before you go, and you do it for two reasons. You do it for a practical reason, makes life easier. But the other reason you do it for is for respect. And if we can just embrace that sense of respect when we're on other people's countries, I then feel hopeful for the future of Australia. And that's the easiest way to implement those kind of ideas or to get those ideas across is through education and our next generation. It's nourishing work. And I'm hopeful that in 10 years from now or 5 years from now, or maybe it's even next year, that there'll be more and more Indigenous languages being taught in schools across the country.
Well, I hope for that too. And look, Tara, thank you so much for taking time out to speak with me. I found the yield to be just beautiful and enlightening and resonated with me in so many ways, and actually gave me this beautiful history lesson as well of these people living in this place. So thank you so much for writing it and taking time out to talk about it today.
Thanks for having me again. It's been great.